Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, a big step forward for girls wrestling in Iowa. We will preview the AAU Girls State Wrestling Championship coming up this weekend. But first, bison once roamed the plains in herds so large that the early settlers and explorers couldn't even estimate their numbers. These giant mammals were an important part of the ecosystem. They played a very important role in the lives of Native Americans, but in a few short decades, they were purposely hunted nearly to extinction. Dan O'Brien is an author, a conservationist, and a bison rancher in South Dakota. He's just written a new book called Great Plains Bison, and he's on the line with me now. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Charity. How are you?
Great. Thank you so much for being here today.
Yeah, it's good to be here. I'm actually in Florida, which is a good place to be. It was 22 below when I left South Dakota. So
nice, but significantly fewer bison in Florida.
Right.
Dan, before we start talking about the history of bison in North America, when did you first feel a connection with this species?
Well, I think that when I first came out to South Dakota, which was in 1970, and came face to face with my first bison. There's something that takes your breath away when you look one right in the eyes, and I think that that's a universal reaction. From that time on, I started thinking about the environment, and more that bison came up in my thoughts.
What made you decide that you would ranch in South Dakota and have your own herd of bison?
Well, that came much later. I started working in South Dakota as a raptor specialist, that is, birds of prey. And I worked for South Dakota, state of South Dakota, for 7 years. And then I went to work for the Peregrine Fund, which was out of Cornell at the time. And what we were doing was raising in captivity and releasing peregrine falcons. I was interested in your eagle you have laying an egg this mm-hmm. early. And then as the peregrine falcon slowly made its way off the endangered species list, I was sort of looking around for what do I do now kind of a thing. And what I'd learned over those 14 years was that single-species conservation is really kind of a fool's errand. It's about the environment, and it's about the whole system. And so I started looking around at the species diversity and the Great Plains, because I'd been working from Canadian border to the Mexican border, basically right down to the Great Plains. And I looked around and I thought, well, you know what? There's a lot of things missing here. You know, we've extirpated so many species, but what's the keystone species? And it only takes you a second to get to buffalo. And so that was 20 some years ago, and I've been sort of working on this idea ever since.
Well, for people who aren't as familiar with that concept of a keystone species, tell me about the place that the buffalo or the bison hold in that ecosystem.
Well, this is true of all ecosystems, that there are certain animals that you really can't do without, because you start a trophic cascade if you lose those animals. That is, things start to come unglued all the way down to the microbes. And on the Great Plains, the bison or buffalo, same thing, is indisputably one of those animals. Their impact on the flora and fauna of the Great Plains is what makes the Great Plains what they are.
Explain that a little bit more, because I think a lot of us think about, you know, bison walking around, eating some plants. What do they actually do that shapes the land?
Well, first of all, they are you know, they're big creatures, as we all know, but you know, they're not any bigger than cattle, and I don't know quite how they got that reputation, but they you know, they have a physical impact on the land. Their hooves are made a little differently than any other herbivore, and the plants on the Great Plains, the original plants on the Great Plains, of course, evolved to respond positively to the action of those hooves. Bison also stay very close together. It's not like you see one or two bison scattered around, although you may see some old bulls around like that. But basically, we have a herd on our ranch, and they're almost always together. And it's a pretty good size herd, so it has an impact on the land, which is the grasses and the plants particularly. And one of the things about the Great Plains is that it's not a question of grazing easily. It's a question of grazing hard and then resting. It's the rest that makes the grass healthy. And buffalo move, as we all know, they're roamers. And as they move, they'll vacate an area and let it rest. And those kind of actions really make a difference. They do not go into the riparian zones very often. That is the water courses and things like that. Probably evolved to stay away from the grizzly bears. And that, as everybody knows about cattle, that's where the cattle go, and they're very hard on those riparian zones. They need them in the wintertime, and they need them to stay warm, and they need them in the summertime to stay cool. Buffalo don't need that. So this is a different critter. They're not just walking around out there. They are impacting with every step.
Well, and reading descriptions from the early settlers and the early explorers of the buffalo herds that they saw, I mean, it's enough to take your breath away. And we really can't know how many there were, can we?
No, and in the book I go into some of the history of that and people trying to figure out, you know, we're being basically, Europeans, we got to have numbers, you know, we want things to add up. And we really don't know how many buffalo there were. Certainly millions, probably 30 to 40 million. That's a lot of buffalo. But we don't know. No one was really studying them. They seem to just take them for granted as Europeans take, you know, all resources for granted, and they just used them up as fast as they could.
Right. When I think about your herd moving around on your land and the impact that you see, and then I think about those descriptions of millions of bison in one herd where they would move across the land and people could observe them, that single herd moving for days because it was that large that it took them more than a day to pass a certain point. What the impact on the land must have been so much greater, magnified by so many more creatures.
Oh, and there's no question about that. That's the little bit of science that we gleaned from that era, is that they would come through, and it wasn't that they were, you know, gentle on the land. It's that they were hard on the land, which gave the forbs and the grasses a chance to reseed, to be replanted by the hoof action. But basically, they had to devastate an area and then move on. And we see that in miniature on our ranch. We've got about 700 buffalo out there now, and they move 3 or 4 miles a day, I would guess. And all the time they're moving, they're massaging that prairie as if they're lovers. This is something that both the species and the ecosystem needs.
We also, in thinking about this history, we have an idea of Native Americans hunting buffalo, and many American Indians, their tribes were very dependent on the buffalo. But more so after that initial contact with Europeans, right? I mean, the horse really dramatically changed the American Indians' relationship with the buffalo.
Yeah, when you look at the history, I mean, you know, what we know of the history of North America, humans, 12,000 years ago, were hunting buffalo or the ancestors of buffalo in most cases, but they were doing it all off foot, which I would think would make it pretty tough. But for a long, long time, for 11,000 years or something, they did it off foot, and only when the Spanish brought the new and improved horse back to North America, in the galleons in Mexico, basically, did the Indians get the horse. And, of course, you know, they're resourceful outfits, so they started riding them and trying to hunt buffalo off of them and became pretty darn efficient at it. But that was only, 300 years ago?
Right.
This is almost a blink of the eye.
And so becoming more efficient at hunting buffalo, there were so many that really didn't impact the species very much, but it did impact the culture of American Indians a lot.
Huge, huge. Yeah, they, you know, the American Indians, as best we know, were omnivores and, did some raising of corn, et cetera, along the river bottoms, and where they were really confined. They couldn't move across the Great Plains because they didn't have any way to do it except to walk. So they stayed in the river bottoms, but they would come up on top every chance they got to hunt a few buffalo, add a little protein to their diet. And they did that for many, many centuries before they found another way to live on the Great Plains.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a few minutes. I'm talking with Dan O'Brien. He is an author, a conservationist, and a bison rancher in South Dakota. He's just written a new book called Great Plains Bison. It's part of the Discover the Great Plains series. And we will continue our conversation about the history of bison, their relationship with humans, and their future as well, coming up in just a moment on Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up later this hour, a big step forward for girls wrestling in Iowa. We will find out what's going on in about 15 minutes. With me right now is Dan O'Brien. He's an author, a conservationist, and a bison rancher in South Dakota. He's just written a new book called Great Plains Bison. And we're talking about the history of this species in North America. And we were talking just before the break about how horses really changed how Native Americans interacted with the bison and how then the bison shaped their culture. In fact, you, in your book, you write about the bison or the buffalo and their relationship to Native Americans. You refer to them as the Buffalo Nation. Why is that?
Well, this is a little bit interesting. I had an argument with the editor on this book. I wanted to capitalize buffalo because in the area that I live, which is right, we butt up against the Pine Ridge Reservation for about 8 miles, and the Lakota people who are surround us, and we are related actually, believe that buffalo are their cousins. I mean, and they actually believe this, and so they are a buffalo nation. So it's a group of buffalo that is our nation, like the Lakota people. And so I figured that since it was a nation, I ought to capitalize it. They wouldn't let me do it, though.
As I mentioned before, the buffalo were so numerous that even that increased hunting that the horse allowed didn't really impact the species very much. But as we know, this is a species that was hunted to the brink of extinction. A lot of that, of course, it came with the settlers, but a lot of it came after the Civil War. And it wasn't just that the buffalo was taken for granted and hunted to extinction, but you write that this was an actual purposeful approach, an attempt to rid the land of buffalo.
Yeah, it definitely was. General Sherman, who basically took over the region of the West after the Civil War, is quoted as saying on many occasions that we have to strike the Indians at their commissary. And what he meant by that was, if we destroy the buffalo, we destroy the Indians and we win the war.
So he, generals killed buffalo, the army killed buffalo, but they decided it wasn't enough.
Well, they actually began at one point to fund the hide hunters. And the idea that someone discovered the idea that buffalo hide was a little different than cattle hide. And that this was during the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, when we needed a lot of belting. We didn't have any rubber, like we have our rubber belts for machinery now. So they built the belts out of leather, and they found out that bison made great belts. And by God, they were free. You know, nobody owned them. So let's just kill them. And the government ended up, our government, ended up funding these hide hunters and supporting them, protecting them from the Indians, who were at this point then fighting for their lives.
Right.
So it was really a conspiracy to get rid of the buffalo, further point is that they wanted the buffalo off the land so they could plow it, because buffalo don't they don't recognize fences sometimes, and people would try to fence off 40 acres to grow some wheat, and the buffalo would walk right through the fence. So they figured, we have to clear the land of buffalo.
The railroad made hunting a lot easier, but it also divided the buffalo herd, right, into really a southern and a northern herd.
Exactly. When the railroad went through right after the Civil War, I mean, you have to think about, you got hundreds of thousands of men, active, sometimes violent men, are suddenly released to go out on their own. And a lot of them came west. And, you know, when you got the buffalo hunters, you got the cowboys and all those people, it was a post-Civil War culture in a lot of ways. And when the railroad went through, on either side of the railroad, and some of you know the story about just how the railroad scammed a lot of free ground. It was basically a swath right through the buffalo herd in Nebraska, and that swath became developed, and the buffalo were split. There was a northern herd, southern herd. Then they went to work on the southern herd because it was a little less wild, it was less protected by the Indians. And when they finished off all the buffalo in the south, they moved to the north, which is where I live.
When the buffalo were killed, when they were driven to the brink of extinction, that did put the nail in the coffin for most Native American tribes. I mean, that was the moment of defeat, wasn't it?
Well, it really was for the Great Plains tribes, for sure. And of course, you know, that's iconic. Native American is the native on horseback. But you know, actually, that was just the Plains Indians. But they couldn't survive without the buffalo, and they couldn't survive without free access.
The buffalo, as I mentioned, I mean, they were hunted to the brink of extinction. How close did they get? Because it was very close.
Well, of course, the numbers we're not sure of, but the best estimates are that we got down to less than 1,000 buffalo out of probably 40 million, and less than 1,000, some people say 400. And they were, and of course, if you thought much about evolution and genetics, you know that that's not enough to sustain a healthy herd. Things change when you get to, that small a number. But there were a couple of foresighted people that stepped up and tried to, quote, save the buffalo. And in a lot of ways, they did. This was the Smithsonian Institute, people like Theodore Roosevelt, people that understood a little bit about the science of ecology, though they didn't even have a name for it then. But they put the animals in the Bronx Zoo. They put them on a couple of reserves out in the West. And so the buffalo staggered forward as a species.
And there were some buffalo that had been kept by ranchers, right?
Correct. There's that's kind of one of the interesting stories to me, one of many interesting stories. But there were some ranchers that, and these were big-time guys, that, they knew buffalo. They had seen the big herds. And as they started, because they started a precipitous crash. I mean, in 10 or 15 years, most of them were gone. And these guys felt nostalgic, I think, and probably felt some nascent twinges of ecology. And so they would go out and grab some of these few baby buffalo that were running around. People were killing their moms as fast as they could. They took them back and started raising them, which was, not easy to do in those days.
Well, and a lot of them actually bred with cattle, right?
Well, they did, and they don't breed readily with cattle. They need to be sort of forced into it, confined with a cow or a bull or whatever. And so that never really worked well. But they did do that, which, of course, to my way of thinking, if there's a sin, that's probably it.
Well, it also means that many of the buffalo that exist today actually carry some DNA from cattle.
That's true. There's it's probably a much smaller number than it has been publicized how many carry cattle genes. And we, now that we have a genome for buffalo, we kind of understand it a little bit more. And pretty quickly, those cattle genes are being weaned out of the national herd.
When today, buffalo have made something of a comeback, but today we can encounter them here in Iowa at the Neil Smith Wildlife Refuge Prairie Preserve. We can encounter them, of course, at Custer State Park in South Dakota and at Yellowstone Park. We see these herds that look like wild herds, but there aren't any truly wild herds, are there?
No, there really aren't. And in fact, nothing is wild anymore. Even the birds are corralled around and moved around according to our will. So the idea of something being wild is kind of a fantasy in 2020.
Tell me what you've learned from observing your herd, because, of course, this is a managed herd. But first of all, tell me, you try to give your buffalo the opportunity to live a life that is as close to what they would naturally have as possible. What do you do to make that happen?
Well, the first thing that we have to do, and you nailed it. I mean, that's what we try to do with our businesses. We try to let buffalo be as close to a wild buffalo as possible. And the main element in that is a lot of room. So we figure every buffalo on our place has to have access to about 50 acres every day per buffalo. So if you got 1,000 buffalo, it's 50,000 acres. And that's hard to do in this day and age. It's hard to put that kind of a place together. And we're fortunate in a lot of ways, but particularly fortunate because we're surrounded by public land. And most of the land that we run our buffalo on belongs to you and to everybody that's listening to this program. It's the national forests, the national grasslands. And we've had to petition different ways to get, oddly enough, permission to run buffalo on the national grasslands, which, of course, the biologists understand. Some of the cattlemen don't. But you need those kind of expanses. A buffalo standing in a one-acre pen is not really a buffalo. They, one of the key elements of a buffalo is movement.
You are a rancher, though, so this is part of how you make your living, selling buffalo, right?
Correct, correct. And, you know, I learned a long time ago that I'm a pessimist on the future of the environment and the Great Plains in particular, because that's my environment. But I, you know, I see it being destroyed. I'm 70 years old now. I've watched it for over 50 years, and the deterioration is immense. And so I got to thinking, how can we help this? You know, picking up pop cans in the road ditch is not enough. So I thought, well, what has destroyed this landscape and our future, really? And I come to capitalism, and I know it's a tricky subject, but the Industrial Revolution was the beginning of a lot of destruction. And so I thought, well, what's powerful enough to combat that kind of consumptive capitalism? And I said, well, capitalism itself. So we started a business where we sell, we raise and sell buffalo that is completely wild, not completely wild, as wild as they can get. And it's, of course, just grass is all it ever eats. And we found a market for that, and people are paying for it. And we turn any profits that we make into more land for more buffalo. And that's, you know, our real, our product is conservation. The buffalo meat is a side product.
You make it clear in your book that you think everyone should have an opportunity to see buffalo up close. What do you want people to take away from that experience when they encounter buffalo, maybe for the first time or maybe for the first time in a really mindful way?
Well, you know, I don't think, at least in my experience, it's the first time you see a buffalo is a profound event, especially if you're an American. I mean, that is as iconically American as you get. I mean, that's it. And I think that people should have a chance to see buffalo, not just a buffalo, but a buffalo standing surrounded by millions of acres of healthy Great Plains. That, you know, that's where the American character was hammered out. That's when we think of America, we think of distance, freedom, ability to move, and the buffalo it engulfs all of those things. And so when people come into contact with the buffalo, they're going to feel those things if they have a heartbeat. They'll understand what I'm talking about.
We've talked about a really shameful history with the buffalo, part of a really troubling part of our nation's history. What do you think people need to take away from that story?
Well, first of all, you're right. I mean, it was shameful. I mean, it's amounted to following the idea that buffalo are a nation of their own. It was a pogrom. You know, it was a the killing off for reasons that are so basically negative that it's embarrassing. And I think what we should do is first accept responsibility for what we did, our ancestors did, etc., and then try to really think of a way to preserve the Great Plains And if we think of the Great Plains in that way, the buffalo will come back. They're there. They're waiting.
Well, Dan O'Brien, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Well, it's a pleasure, Charity. Thanks.
Dan O'Brien is the author of the new book, Great Plains Bison. It's part of the series Discover the Great Plains. He is an author, a conservationist, and a bison rancher in South Dakota when he's not vacationing in Florida. Coming up in just a few minutes, more and more girls in Iowa are taking part in wrestling. Most of the time, they still wrestle with the boys, but coming up this weekend, the very first AAU Girls High School State Wrestling Championship is going to happen. We'll get a preview in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.